Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Since August 14th, the United States has evacuated more than 58,000 Americans and Afghan allies from Afghanistan. Several Massachusetts organizations are assisting in resettling Afghan refugees here. Earlier today, we spoke with Syed. He and his wife were resettled through the Special Immigrant Visa Program in May 2019 with help from the International Institute of New England. The Afghan SIV program was created in 2009 to help Afghan allies and their families that are employed by or on behalf of the U.S. government to emigrate to the U.S. Now, Syed and his wife both still have family in Afghanistan. We are not using his last name to keep that family safe. When we talked, we started by asking Syed, given the risks, why he wanted to speak with us and what he wants the world to know.
Thank you for giving me this chance. I would like the world to know what's going on over there, especially for the families of those individuals like me, my wife, who served the United States government in Afghanistan. They are saying like everyone is safe right now at this moment, but I think this is a policy they trying to show a different face at this stage that they're going to make a government in Afghanistan.
So excuse me for interrupting you, but when you say they here, are you referring to the Taliban?
Yes, exactly. So once they have everything, the government is made, so I'm sure they're going to show their real face, and I'm afraid of that.
What are you afraid will happen?
I'm afraid what all those things that they did in 25 years ago, they do it again. I believe these are the same Taliban. Maybe they're a little bit educated, but still their beliefs are the same. And I'm afraid of that.
Do you have reason to believe that they'll be able to identify yours and your wife's extended families in Afghanistan?
Yes, I believe in that because before we come here, we got our passport, we become biometrics. So each and every information of us is available right now in Afghanistan, in Kabul. So right now they have access to all those data, my family background, my family list. And they, if they search, they will find out that I am in United States right now. And under my name, there's my family list, their contacts, their information, where they live. So all this information is like easily available to them. And this is a great risk for my family at this moment.
When did you last speak to your family?
I try to have a contact with them on a daily basis because I don't know like if one day I wake up and I try to call them and I hear like, they're disappeared or they're not available anymore. But usually 2 days after 2 days or 1 day, like I find them and talk to them for a few minutes and they say to me, we are safe, we are underground. And then I become a little bit calm.
Are you sleeping at night?
This is a nightmare. Yeah, I sleep, but I have my nightmare. My wife, during the night, different times, many times she wake up and she cried and like, I'm okay physically, but mentally we are destroyed. And I can sleep, but I have nightmare in my sleeps, in my dreams.
I'm sorry, Syed. You and your wife have been here since 2019. You came on a special immigrant visa. And that was because of your wife's work with USAID-funded projects. Is that correct?
Yes, right.
What made the two of you decide to leave and apply for this visa?
Even in 2019 or before that, I was not sure that we can have a good future in Afghanistan. And there was always a possibility that this government, this army will collapse one day. And that happens right now.
When you came to Massachusetts, did you have help? And tell us about that first night you spent here in the Commonwealth and away from your home country.
Yeah, the first night I remember, I was in one of my friend's home. I was happy that at least my life, my wife's life is safe. But even from 2019 till now, every day, every moment, whenever I'm going out, whenever I'm at home, whenever I'm visiting a beautiful places, I feel of my family. I wish that they were with me right now. There are some child in my family that they're so cute, and I'm thinking, oh my God, if they were here with us right now, so I had no this tension, this stress which I'm having right now, and the life was much more beautiful.
Do you think you will be able to bring your wife's family and your family to the States? Do you think they'll be able to join you here?
At this moment, I don't know that if we are able to do this or no, but we are trying because their life is at great risk because of us, because of my wife. She was working with the United States, and I hope this will happen very soon. But at this moment, I have no idea what's going to happen. I'm not sure about anything.
And I am sorry to ask you this difficult question, but if they can't join you here, what do you believe their future is in Afghanistan?
As I think, they're going to go back to 25 years ago in 1996 to 2001, where like Taliban ruling Afghanistan. They're going to go back to those dark age. And my sister, she's doing business administration. I guess she is in sixth semester. My brother, he was doing dental art, fourth semester. So even right now, after like 10 days, Taliban ruling Afghanistan, the schools or universities are all closed, and my family, they are underground. And we don't know that if they are again able to go for education or no. This is the main concern. My mother, 25 years ago, she lost the opportunity to get education because of Taliban insurgent at that time, and she couldn't do it. She had only seventh grade, I guess, in school. After that, she left, and she was not able to continue her education. And I'm afraid if the same thing today happened to my sister, which is 21 years old, and I'm afraid of that.
What gives you hope now, Syed?
Yes. My main concern is my family members, but it's not like ending to my family. It's about my country. There are lots of girls and boys, child, like my family members, they have no hope at this moment. Sometimes whenever I'm talking about these things, about my family, whenever I'm thinking about their future, that what's going to happen to them, it's really break my heart. And sometimes even I cry. My wife and I, the other weekend, we were out and we had a coffee with us, and we sat down on a bench in a park. And we were just thinking, and suddenly both of us cried together. And even right now I have that feeling. Maybe you can understand it from my, but let's see what will happen. I just can be hopeful for the future, and thank you for giving me the chance to say something about my country, my family today.
That was Syed. We have agreed to withhold his last name for the safety of he and his wife's families in Afghanistan. The two of them came to the United States on a special immigrant visa in May of 2019 after she worked for several years on USAID-funded projects. Syed, thank you. We will be thinking about both of your families.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Let's turn now to Emma Tobin. Amma is the chief program officer for the International Institute of New England, which assisted Syed and his wife coming to the United States on a special immigrant visa. Amma, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
Let me start by just getting your reactions to what you just heard from Syed, Amma.
Yeah, I mean, I have spent a lot of the last week, and I guess at this point a week and a half, talking with Syed and with other Afghan community members living in Massachusetts and gathering information about their extended families that are still in Afghanistan in order to try to, you know, support those folks to be evacuated and come to the United States. But hearing someone tell their story for the sake of telling the story and sort of in that emotional way, it hits you. It hits you differently than when you're, you know, filling out a massive Excel chart and just trying to get all the information. So, I mean, honestly, Syed made me cry when I heard him tell his story again this morning.
I want to ask you, you know, so you've been collecting this information for the last week in this massive spreadsheet you just referred to. You went into that eyes wide open. You've been doing this work. But I imagine there are still things you learned in the last week. What have you learned in the last, say, 7 days talking to families?
Oh, I have learned so much, and I'm still learning so much, because I have been working with refugees and other immigrants and forced migrants for my whole career. But this situation is, every situation is different, but this situation is truly, I think, something unique, and maybe all of us are learning every single moment. So, you know, the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program has some pretty strictly enforced protocols and practices that we follow, and we are very much outside of those right now, in kind of an uncharted territory.
So I want to ask you to help people picture what the experience for somebody coming to the States as a refugee, that first 48 hours getting support from an institution like yours, what that looks like. Start with, you know, they get to the airport.
Sure. So even before a person arrives at the airport, the International Institute of New England will receive a travel notification that a refugee individual or family is coming. And we often have a week or 2 or 3 weeks at the most to prepare for that family to arrive. And so that sort of starts a flurry of activity where we're looking for an appropriate apartment for that family. We're getting it furnished and set up and ready. And by the time the family arrives, which is usually, you know, after midnight at Logan Airport, we're there to pick them up. And we bring them to that apartment. We have a warm meal ready for them. The federal government requires that it be a culturally appropriate meal. And of course, we want to do our best to do that. And we show people how to use the appliances in their new home, to how to use the heat if they've never had to use heat before, and basically how to spend their first night safely in this apartment. The next day we come back, and that starts this intensive 90-day period of what is the refugee resettlement program.
And what is invisible to people that people should know about the trauma and the experience of families coming to the U.S. as refugees, frankly, coming to the Commonwealth as refugees?
I think that everyone should understand, first and foremost, and I hope that this would be obvious, but I'll say it, that refugees are people, and their experiences and their lives are as diverse as any group of people that you will meet. But I do think that there's a commonality, and that commonality is just incredible resilience and persistence, because even to arrive at the point where you're, you know, landing at Logan Airport after midnight as a refugee, you have already been through so much and you've navigated so many things. And I watch our clients continue to navigate so many things, people learning to read and write in any language for the first time in their lives at 55 years old, you know, kids going to school where they're learning in their fifth language, people arriving as refugees during a pandemic where they have to immediately quarantine, just so many things that people manage to make their way through and to live really meaningful lives in Massachusetts.
How many refugees from Afghanistan have you settled, say, in the last few weeks, and how many do you anticipate as a result of this evacuation?
The numbers from the last few weeks are low, We have received Afghans in our offices that whose status is frankly unclear. They're arriving with paperwork that we've never seen before, and we're still trying to piece together what their immigration status is and which services we're meant to provide to them. So the numbers are fairly low from the last few weeks. We've resettled over 330 Afghan people in New England since 2014, and we are preparing to receive at least that many evacuees within the state, not all through our agency, but within the state, there are other resettlement providers as well, and to be providing them with essentially emergency resettlement services, since we are in such an unprecedented moment here.
So to that point, so the Trump administration reduced the number of refugees the U.S. would support bringing to the country. Over the course of that presidency, he cut the number from 85,000 to 18,000. And then, of course, even fewer people came because of the pandemic. And that meant organizations cut staff because staff are at least partially paid by resettlement contracts. So now we have this influx. How much staff did you guys cut back during those lean years? And how hard is it to scale up quickly enough now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's a situation that many refugee resettlement agencies are probably really struggling with in this moment. I think we are lucky in that we were able to be nimble during the Trump years and the pandemic and sort of pivot and provide services to other immigrants of different immigration statuses and to secure other types of public and private funding to support that work. So while our teams are smaller than they were, pre-Trump presidency, they're not that small. And actually in this moment, we're actively recruiting two case managers to join our team who speak Dari and Pashto so that we will be prepared to receive the Afghans who are arriving in Massachusetts.
And in a sentence, Emma, how can listeners who want to help right now?
We need financial support to do this work. We have been told that there will be federal funding on the way, but that we need to be ready to bring in private resources as well in order to resettle these people in large numbers very rapidly. And we need that support.
All right. That was Emma Tobin, the Chief Program Officer for the International Institute of New England. Emma, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
What does it take for a Black arts organization to thrive and be sustainable in Boston? Two local organizations are betting that a short-term partnership is part of that equation. The Front Porch Arts Collective, a Black theater company dedicated to advancing racial equity through the arts, is teaming up with the Huntington Theater Company in a three-year residency. The Front Porch will use the Huntington's infrastructure as it works towards being financially sustainable, and in turn will bring the Huntington and its audiences new talent and programming. The partners hope the outcome will give the city its largest sustainable Black theater company, but also start to address historical privilege for predominantly white institutions, or PWIs. We are joined by Maurice Emanuel Parent, the co-producing artistic director at the Front Porch Arts Collective, and Michael Masso, the managing director at the Huntington Theater Company, to talk about the partnership. Maurice, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
And Michael, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
So Maurice, how did this residency program come to be?
Sure, and thank you all for inviting me here today. And again, I'm calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. That's the unceded land of the Massachusetts and Pawtucket people. And I'm excited to talk about this partnership. It came about a few ways. So as you said, our mission is to advance racial equity in Boston through theater. And shortly after starting the company, we found ourselves in a residency at Central Square Theater. They were also our fiscal sponsors. So through that partnership, we were able to engage with donors, get some support from foundations. And that lasts about 4 years. And we're really grateful for that support. But we found ourselves at an inflection point. Our long-term goal was always self-sustainability and autonomy, and we weren't quite sure how to get there. So with support from the Boston Foundation, we were able to enter into a strategic planning process with Technical Development Corp. And they helped us to do some market research, talk to our partners, our constituents, they interviewed the staff, and we determined the best way to take the next step towards our eventual goal of self-sustainability would be to do what we're calling a bridge residency with a larger theater company that will give us some amount of autonomy and self-determination, but still provide that critical support that a residency offers. So that support with overhead, a lot of things you mentioned. So we drafted a proposal, submitted to a number of organizations, and Huntington was one of the first to respond. And after a number of conversations, we determined this is the perfect organization to partner with, considering where we are today.
So, Michael, I mean, the nonprofit landscape competes for scarce resources. Sometimes arts organizations compete for ticket buyers, et cetera. Why is it essential for Huntington to help the Front Porch Collective, Arts Collective, become sustainable? Why is that essential for our Boston community?
Well, I do think it's essential for the Boston community. It's also natural for the Huntington for really two reasons. The first is that serving the Greater Boston Theater community is really a fundamental part of our work. And we've done that through providing space, let's say at the Calderwood Pavilion, pavilion services and first-class facilities for now. It's 15 years at the Calderwood at subsidized rates. And we believe that we're an essential component to keeping this theater community healthy and growing and achieving its greatest potential. And at the same time, we've spent the past year, like our entire field, but certainly deeply at the Huntington, dealing with the racial reckoning that we are as a field grappling with. And one of the things we made a commitment to was to continue our work in trying to specifically help BIPOC theater companies. So when Maurice and Dawn and Pascal came to us with this proposal, it just was a natural fit and an extension and a next step that we could take to really put our money where our mouth is and to expand our service to the community by focusing on this company. It also helped that we have such enormous respect. Maurice, I think, is heading into his sixth Huntington production later this year. He is somebody who we have enormous admiration for. Dawn is a very prominent arts artist and arts administrator. And Pascal used to be a staff member at the Huntington. So we're
just... And Dawn and Pascal are both at Front Porch, correct?
Yes, I'm sorry. Dawn is the... Is Maurice's co-producing artistic director, and Pascal is the education director. And so we just couldn't be more delighted to, in essence, welcome them home and be part of this journey.
So, Maurice, I'll turn back to you. In your first answer, you talked a lot about what is necessary when one runs an institution, things that have to do with long-term viability, right? At the same time, as Michael just alluded to, we have been having a public conversation in Boston for a while now about the whiteness of our cultural institutions and challenges to diversifying our cultural audiences because our institutions have historically not been welcoming. 3 years from now, when this collaboration is successful, Front Porch is sustainable and now the largest sustainable Black arts organization in the city. What changes?
Oh, what an amazing question. Thank you for that. A few things. I think, first of all, we need to examine those invisible barriers that are keeping the audiences so white and the experiences so white, even when the experience on stage is rooted in Black cultural and the stories of the African diaspora. So once we start examining those invisible barriers, some of those might be the feeling of being policed in the space when you feel like as a person of the global majority, you're in the space, you're feeling watched, you can't be your truest self, your authentic self in response to what you're seeing, and really addressing those things. But it comes from defining the space as a home for all. And especially when the shows reflect cultures of the global majority, you are not only invited, but you are at home in the space. So once there's some ownership of that space, hopefully we start seeing the change, the tides change in terms of these perspectives. I'm sorry, these are percentages of the audiences. So in 3 years, we're seeing a thriving Black theater company that certainly we serve the entire Boston area. But we'd like to say everyone's welcome to the table as long as you know kind of what's on the menu. We know that we are building an organization that's going to center, you know what I'm saying? Everyone's welcome to the cookout. Just, you know, we're going to provide the potato salad. So like, you know, you're going to come to the theater that the Front Porch Arts Collective is producing within, and know that these stories, these people are going to be centered. If you're cool with that, you're welcome to the party, right? And if you're not, there's many other arts for you to consume. So in 3 years, you're seeing a sustainable Black theater company. You're also seeing an ecosystem that has looked at these invisible barriers and been proactively trying to dismantle them. So that's one of our parts of our mission as well. We're working with our organizations to really look at our friends, our partner organizations, other artists, to really look at these invisible barriers and build programs that strategically try to dismantle them and see what's keeping them so powerful for so long.
And Michael, last question to you, just briefly, what's a way you hope Huntington Theater Company will transform itself as a result of this partnership?
Oh, I think that we will have great input into our programming from Front Porch. We will have real lived experience in terms of artists who work as artists of color in this community on an ongoing basis. You know, the Huntington has worked with many artists the last full year of production before COVID. Over half of our artists were artists of color, but those are independent artists coming for one show at a time. And, you know, we've had Melinda Lopez as a playwright in residence, and now this is just an expansion of the vision and the voice of artists of color. And we think it will deepen our work and make us more in tune with the world we want to be.
All right. That is Michael Masso, the managing director at the Huntington Theater Company, and Maurice Emmanuel Parent, the co-producing artistic director at the Front Porch Arts Collaborative. Michael, Maurice, thanks to both of you.
A pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Pam.
Earlier today, the State Education Board gave the authority to Education Commissioner Jeff Riley to impose a universal mask mandate in Massachusetts schools through at least October 1st. It's anticipated that Riley will officially issue that mandate sometime this week, and it's a change from Governor Baker's earlier policy of leaving that decision to individual districts. It comes as the two-dose Pfizer vaccine got full FDA approval for people age 16 and up yesterday, and as COVID-19 hospitalizations statewide are nearing a four-month high. 139 people of those patients are in intensive care, highest number in more than 3 months. The positive test rate is slightly down at 2.5%. So, raises a lot of questions. What are yours? Whether it's about the Delta variant, vaccines, the virus in general, masking, call us. It is time for Ask the Doctors. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our doctors this week, Dr. Cassandra Pierre, acting hospital epidemiologist and an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center, and Dr. Shira Durone, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Pierre, Dr. Durone, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Great to be back.
So I got a little tongue-tied there, but I feel like it's not inappropriate given the onslaught of information that's coming at us about COVID-19 and vaccines and boosters, et cetera. But I want to start with this latest piece of news expected this week, which is that Commissioner Riley will issue the masking mandate for all public K-12 students through October 1st. I want to note that middle and high schools will be allowed to lift the masking mandate after that if at least 80% of staff and students are vaccinated. So Dr. Pierre, what is your reaction to this move by the state?
I think it's a good move. I think it removes the burden of having to interpret data and think about what a particular school district will and won't tolerate, or specifically what parents will and won't have issues with. And it's based on science. We know that masking is part of a package of interventions that have been shown to be effective in limiting in-classroom transmission, even in communities in our country and other countries where COVID-19 transmission has been high. I do worry about the time frame. Of course, by October 1st, we'll be able to reevaluate, but we also worry that, similar to last year, with the change in weather, people moving more indoors will have increases in COVID transmissions among adults and potentially school-aged children. So I do think it's important to think about continuing indoor mask mandates beyond that point. And then also, although we have stated that, you know, we want everyone to be vaccinated, including school-age children. We also do know that as a population level with our waning immunity to moderate and mild disease, waiting for a vaccination rate in a school environment that's higher might still leave the door open for some breakthrough infections as well. But overall, this is a really good move. Again, relieving the burden of having to make these decisions by the school boards themselves so that they can really focus on doing the work at hand to get kids ready for school.
Dr. Daron, I'm going to turn to you for your reactions. I do want to note, I misspoke. It's 2.6% positivity test rate here in the Commonwealth right now. I think I said 2.5. What is your reaction to this move by the state to impose a mask mandate in K-12 schools?
I think it's just right, too. And I think what this signals on the part of the commissioner and the board is that they take COVID-19 seriously, in particular, the danger that is associated with the Delta variant, but that they're also using data-driven metrics to think about what that off-ramp might look like. And, you know, over the past few weeks, this issue has become so polarized with parents and educators and legislators on, you know, with such strong feelings on either side of this issue. And this is really a way to bridge that gap. And I really have faith in the commissioner that over the next month plus until October 1st, additional data will be taken into account. And if there needs to be a change to that metric or that approach, that will happen.
So Dr. Pierre, you and Dr. Daron have sounded similar themes here. So then I do want to note that there are exceptions for students under 5 and students with certain medical conditions. What is the case for leaving students who fall under that exception unmasked, given what the two of you have just laid out?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, when we're looking at data-driven responses, there have been less information available to us about the efficacy of masks and the ability for children in that age range, or the under 5 age range, to consistently wear them appropriately. I certainly, as a mother of 2 3-year-olds, feel like, you know, many children can wear them appropriately. But I think the larger concern might also be about development. So, and specifically social, emotional development, ability to understand cues. Many individuals have talked about the fact that masks can stunt those areas of development. And they've also been, on the other hand, some concern that, or not concern, but looking in literature and seeing that younger age ranges are less susceptible to infection, severe disease, and secondary transmission to other individuals. That being said, I do, you know, as with everything, there's always a trade-off in risks. And so while we worry about the emotional, mental health and development of our children, we have seen that COVID-19 can strike younger children as well. So I think it's really part of a risk calculation that has to be made. I do know that, you know, individual parents will still have the ability to consider masking for their children. And again, speaking as a mother to 3-year-olds, we are definitely masking consistently.
Okay, so let's pick up our first call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Susan on the line in North Attleboro. Susan.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is about my son. He's 15. He's previously had COVID. So my husband and I are kind of not seeing eye to eye as to vaccinate or not vaccinate. My husband seems to feel that my son already has some natural immunity because he already has had COVID. So he does not want to vaccinate our son. And my question is, how many kids who have already had COVID are getting reinfected with COVID who have not been vaccinated?
All right, let's turn to Dr. Daron, Susan. Thank you.
Great question. Yeah, so there is natural immunity from prior infection with COVID-19. Like vaccination, it's not perfect at preventing a subsequent episode of COVID-19. Like vaccination, people who do get infected after previously being infected generally have a milder course. What I can say is that when you add vaccination on top of natural immunity, it is more effective than natural immunity alone. But we shouldn't discount that natural immunity does provide some protection.
So this gives me an opportunity also, and Dr. Pierre, I'll ask you this, to raise the point. The caller's child is 15. Pfizer was approved by the FDA, fully approved. The Pfizer vaccine was yesterday. For people ages 16 and older. It is still under emergency use authorization for the younger ages. That intersection of how we know it's safe for one group of people and not another is a question that's come up a lot over the last few weeks. We've also heard a lot of questions about why we are recommending that pregnant women receive the vaccination while pregnant if we don't know that the vaccine is safe for little ones. So what can you tell us?
Yeah, no, that's a great point in terms of thinking about what contradictions might exist. So I think it's important to know here what an authorization versus an approval really gives you. We know we have evidence, we have really strong evidence about data regarding safety for both the 12 to 15 year age group, as well as for pregnant women. And we have a really strong track record of safety for the vaccines in these groups. What we haven't had and what we've been looking for in populations is enough extended data around efficacy for longer periods of time. And looking at the time out that we achieved from the trials, we now have for those older age groups, including for pregnant women, information about longer term efficacy than we did previously. And that plus a number of other issues in looking again at the efficacy of the vaccines after certain amounts of time have passed, has allowed the Pfizer vaccine in particular full approval. But we don't yet have sufficient time data out on efficacy, longer term efficacy for those younger age groups. Now, the safety considerations, we know what they are. Overwhelmingly, these vaccines are safe for all of the age groups that they have been authorized for.
And to clarify, Dr. Pierre, with that research and the data in pregnant women, do we understand the impact on the baby?
Yes. So thank you for explicitly honing in on that. We do know that for pregnant women, and it's over 40,000 and counting at this point for whom we have data, we have not seen abnormal effects on the process of childbirth or on the fetus, on that baby. There's no difference in obstetric outcomes or neonatal outcomes from what we've seen, including for any harm to come to the baby in women who have received the vaccine versus women who have not in the general population. So we feel incredibly comfortable knowing, and CDC has also stated this, that these vaccines are overwhelmingly safe for pregnant women and their children.
Thank you for that. Well, I'm going to go back to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Chris on the line. Chris, I think you're in the car on Route 24, right?
Well, now I'm on 128.
You're moving.
Oh, yes. Thank goodness. I want to thank you all for doing this, you know, daily. I'm wondering, all of my family, except for a couple of holdouts, have had the vaccine. And the reason they were giving, oh, it's experimental in their minds, that's what they believe, and even though I've seen plenty of data that led me to get them myself. But what can we do to get the message out? Because their next excuse, now that it's been approved, was, yeah, but they didn't finish the triple-blind three-year study yet. So what can we do to assure people and put them at rest in some kind of media campaign to make it, you know, clear to people that this is not really experimental at this point? We've got plenty of data points.
Chris, thank you for that question. And Dr. Daron, it strikes me as Chris asks that question, the number of stories I have heard from people over the last couple of weeks about being in family gatherings where most people are vaccinated, but someone isn't, and the challenges that creates in the family dynamic as well. So what's your thought on Chris's question on messaging?
It is so hard. It is causing all kinds of rifts between friends and family members. Again, this is something that is polarizing people, that people feel so strongly on both sides of. And, you know, of course, those of us who believe strongly in vaccination believe it because it saves lives, and we don't want the people we love to get sick and have a bad outcome. You have to listen. You have to be compassionate. It's important to ask, what is it that's making you hesitant? And when you know exactly what the person's reasons are, then you can really address those specific issues. And often a person has learned or heard some specific thing that is misinformation or disinformation. And often we can provide the counter information based on data that show that whatever it is was not real, was not true. But we have to be compassionate, while at the same time increasing access for those who are still having difficulty getting it because they can't leave work or can't afford to have side effects and miss work. And at the same time, you know, it's really come to a point, unfortunately, where, you know, we have to implement those vaccine mandates. Employers, schools, universities are increasingly using those vaccine mandates, and ultimately that will save lives.
Do you agree with that, Dr. Pierre?
I could not agree more. I would actually say that I have a list of patients who I've spoken to over the past few months, and I kind of detail their reasons for not getting vaccinated. So I feel like I have a list of people who I'm like, oh, it's FDA approved. So it's a whole chunk of people I can call and make their appointment for. But I do know that for as many of those who have said that full approval has been the state that at which they will become vaccinated, that many of them will still have questions that they need addressed. And I'm fully prepared to do that. That being said, I do often acknowledge to others in my life that they will be the most important person to speak to, their family member, their colleague, their friend, more even so than me as an individual physician. I feel like we've been saying that throughout this pandemic, everyone's second job has been public health. So being able to listen, as Dr. Jerome lovely stated, it is going to be really important to then engaging them on their specific concern or reason for hesitancy. But yes, I absolutely agree.
1-800-423-8255. We've got Rob on the line in Taunton. Rob, what's your question?
Yes. So I'm going on a family trip with our 16-month toddler. And what I'd like to know is, has airline travel been heavily impacted by the Delta variant? Are there more risks associated with traveling with a toddler during this time?
Thanks, Rob. Dr. Jerome, what do we know?
Well, you know, I haven't seen any specific research papers that talk about airline travel in the era of the Delta variant. You know, what I know is that the success has been variable. Airplanes have really, really good air exchanges and filtration, but there's a lot of people in close contact, and you never know who's going to be right in front of you, behind you, or next to you. We know that the Delta variant is more contagious. It's less forgiving. If you have a super spreader on your flight that's infected with the Delta variant, you could have a lot of infections. You also could get lucky. That being said, travel can be very important for some people, especially those for whom family and close friends are an airplane ride away. And when people ask me if they should travel right now, I tell them to look at their own risk tolerance and how important that trip is. Children, especially the youngest children, tend to fare well when they do get COVID-19. So all of that has to be taken into account, and everybody has to make their own decisions.
All right, so Drs. Jerome and Pierre, our lines are full and we are coming up against the clock. So I'd like to try to do a lightning round here and clear out a few more calls. We'll pick up Lisa in Acton. Lisa, go ahead.
Yes, in going to the gym, I'm wearing my mask and I'm the only person in the gym that's wearing a mask. Is it effective in any way if I'm the only one doing that?
Dr. Pierre.
Yes, absolutely. Your mask will offer you protection to yourself. Please make sure that it is a good mask that is well fitted to your face, and do try to get some distance from others in the gym. Ensure there's good ventilation if you can. But yes, that mask will still offer you good protection.
And let's pick up Alicia in Hopkinton. Alicia, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just with regards to the DESE ruling today, is there anything that's going to come down for those kids who are under 5, who are in pre-K, and half are masked and half are not.
Oh, I don't know if we know that, but Dr. Daron, are you aware of anything?
No, I'm not aware of anything in the works on that.
Okay, let's go to Chris in Lincoln. Chris, go ahead.
Hi, I participated in the AstraZeneca trials back in January, and so I've been vaccinated for quite a while at this point. But with all the discussion of boosters and lack of information on AstraZeneca, I'm wondering if your guests had any thoughts on those few of us who do have AstraZeneca in the United States.
Dr. Pierre.
It's a great question. I think we've been looking for more direction for those who have participated in trials for vaccines that are not EUA approved through our FDA, including Novavax and AstraZeneca. We do have good evidence showing, you know, good immunity or good boosting of immunity with mixing and matching vaccinations, but not necessarily for primary booster properties that we're talking about now. And so just like with Johnson & Johnson, we don't have any data at this point, and the CDC is not prepared to comment, at least not yet, on the boosting or the appropriateness of boosting with the mRNA vaccines for other kinds of vaccines. So we'll have to wait for information about that. And I'm sorry, I don't have more information for you.
All right, so then let's go to Nick in Jamaica Play. Nick, you're on.
I am. I fall under the category of an immunocompromised patient, and I was wondering if the panel, the doctors, had any data or info regarding side effects, in particular from a third, like a booster.
Okay, Dr. Daron.
Yeah, so far the data are very promising in terms of the third dose, and we don't call it a booster for people who are immunocompromised. We call it a third dose because it's really for people who haven't mounted a response, so they don't need a boost. They need an initial response. That side effect seems similar to those of the second dose. Now, part of that is that when you are immunocompromised, you don't mount a very vigorous immune response, and so you aren't expected to have a lot of side effects.
It was lovely of the two of you to do all that rapid fire. Thank you. With our little bit of time left, Dr. Pierre, I'll just pick up one more question that I have for you. Today, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's the top infectious disease doctor in the country, essentially said that we might very well see, quote, a situation where the response goes way up and stays up for a long period of time, end quote, in talking about third shots, boosters. How can we know that now?
Well, I think that part of our knowledge is based on other priming that we've seen with other kinds of vaccine preventable diseases, seeing how vigorously we've responded, and also having a little bit of data at least on what other countries that have experiencing surges have seen after getting that booster, that is at least in the short-term data that we have, decreases in even mild, moderate disease. We may have, we, you know, and also, I
We're
should say, also
out of time,
some lab
just so
data.
You know.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so also some lab data based on what we can see with antibodies and people who've been in clinical trials. We have some early indicators that there is a robust immune response with the third dose, but I really do think that data will be forthcoming. Time will tell.
Okay, you both were wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Cassandra Pierre of the Boston Medical Center, Dr. Shira Daron of Tufts Medical Center. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And listeners, we will do Ask the Doctors again next week. For now, that's our show. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.